The Warfare Series, Part 2, Chasing Lucifer. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? Isaiah 14:12. He who hears you hears me. He who rejects you rejects me, and he who rejects me rejects him who sent me. Then the 70 returned with joy, saying, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. And he said to them, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Behold, I give you the authority to trample on serpents and scorpions, and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall by any means hurt you. Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rather rejoice because your names are written in heaven. Luke 10:16-20. Most of those who come from a Christian fundamentalist orientation, particularly from Pentecostal or charismatic backgrounds, as was I for over 30 years, are taught that there is a continual spiritual warfare being waged around them with demon spirits whose sole purpose lies in preventing them from acquiring all of the goodness God has for their lives while here on earth. The actual spiritual warfare Scripture says we are engaged in, however, is quite different and will be thoroughly discussed in a subsequent article. While not denying the presence of evil in the world or that demon spirits exist in this article, since all of the activities of these spirits are supposedly orchestrated by a central figure, it behooves us to look at this figure in the light of what the original words of Scripture actually say about him. As traditionally taught, his name is Lucifer, more commonly known as Satan or the devil, a rebellious archangel who, having been cast out of heaven to earth from the beginning for his sinful acts, has been engaged in waging a warfare with Yahweh ever since. It will come as a surprise to many to learn that the only reference to a Lucifer in all of Scripture is only found in this verse from Isaiah 14:12, supposedly describing his fall from heaven due to pride. And this name appears only in the King James Version or related versions. In spite of this rendering, however, the proper name Lucifer is not found anywhere in the original Hebrew text or even in the translated Messianic writings. Plus, to add to the confusion, Lucifer is a Latin name. One has to ask, just how did this Latin name find its way into a Hebrew manuscript written centuries before a Roman language even existed? Latin is the language of Rome. Just who is this guy Lucifer, and more importantly, where did he come from? In Hebrew, the phrase translated as the English Lucifer, son of the morning, is Hillel ben Shachar, and should more accurately be translated as Shining One, son of the dawn. There is no proper name mentioned in this passage in the original Hebrew. The context of the whole passage of Isaiah 14 is not about a fallen angel, but an obvious epithet about a fallen Babylonian king who, during his lifetime had persecuted the children of Israel. It also contains no mention of a Satan, either by name or of reference. Why then did the translators of the King James find it necessary to insert Lucifer for Shining One in this passage? The answer lies in two earlier translations. The first translation of the original Hebrew scriptures into Greek occurred 300 years before Yeshua by Ptolemy Philadelphus, the Greek-speaking Pharaoh of Egypt, for his own library. As seen in the last article, Defining Enemies, while local cultures spoke their native languages among themselves, Greek was the universal language spoken between cultures, much as English is the universal language today. The story circulated about this time is that 72 scholars commissioned by Pharaoh to perform this translation became known as the 70, with the translated document itself called the Septuagint, or LXX, the Roman numerals for 70. The original writings found in the Bibles of today are an English translation of this Greek Septuagint, not translated from the original Hebrew texts. In translating Isaiah 14:12, the 70 chose the Greek word hiosphoros for the Hebrew Hillel ben Shachar. Hios means in or of the morning, and phoros means that which is born or bearing. This is not an exact translation of the original Hebrew, but is reasonably close. As empires rose and fell, the fortune of languages rose and fell with them. Since Greek is a very different language than Hebrew, much of the original Hebrew meanings, nuances, and intent became lost in the Septuagint through the ages. The longer the Romans ruled, the more prominent the official language of the Roman Empire became, and that language was Latin. By 325 CE, during the reign of Constantine, the Roman Empire co-opted Gentile Christianity, politicized it, and made it the new state religion. Shortly thereafter, the Latin Father Jerome, who had risen to prominence within the Roman Catholic Church hierarchy, began work on a Latin translation of the Bible at the suggestion of Pope Damasius. After 20 years of toil in the year 405 CE, the translation, now known as the Vulgate, was completed, 7 centuries after the Septuagint translation. While Jerome used the Septuagint version along with the Hebrew in translating to Latin, most historians and biblical scholars concede that the Vulgate can be charged with innumerable faults, inaccuracies, inconsistencies, and arbitrary dealing in particulars. This verse from Isaiah 14:12 stands in testimony to that fact. Jerome did not strictly translate the Hebrew Hillel ben Shachar, nor did he use the Greek hiosphoros, which term by his day had fallen largely into disuse. Instead, he chose to base his translation largely on the Latin word Leucophos, which by Jerome's time had become an epitaph for the Greek gods Apollo and Pan, who were worshipped alongside that of the first light of the dawn, the morning star, Venus. The word Lucifer comes from the Latin lux, meaning light, and ferere, to bear or bring, hence light bringer. But there is no scriptural justification for an arbitrary personification of that translated word. The problem encountered here is, in spite of the traditional theology handed down through hundreds of generations as a result of this arbitrary translation and promoted as truth, it cannot be stated enough that according to the wording of the original Hebrew, the scriptures contain no character named Lucifer. Isaiah had never heard of such a being, nor had the apostles of Yeshua's day, or even Yeshua himself. Lucifer, characterized as a persona who is a manifestation of the devil, is a much later invention. There is no association between Hillel ben Shachar of Isaiah 14:12 and Satan. The proper name Lucifer does not find its way into any translation until Jerome's time, some 150 years after the influence of the writings of earlier Catholic theologians, Tertullian and Origen, who had begun to symbolically read Satan into the story of the king of Babylon in Isaiah 14. However, if read in its proper context, the prophet Isaiah is taunting a man, the king of Babylon, in power at the time. In the poetic and figurative language of the Hebrews, a star signifies an illustrious king or prince. The monarch here referred to, having surpassed all other kings in royal splendor, is compared to the harbinger of day, whose brilliancy surpasses that of the surrounding stars. While there are those who claim that the real entity symbolically addressed in this passage is the persona Satan, there's no scriptural evidence to support this theory. To the contrary, Isaiah 14:16 says, "Is this the man who made the earth tremble?" And in 14:18, "All of the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you are cast out." Clear references to a man, the king of a nation, not an archangel. Then Yahweh's anger was aroused because he went, and the angel of Yahweh took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. Numbers 22:22. There is yet another reason why it makes no sense to read the devil into Isaiah 14. The primary definition of the Hebrew word Satan in the original writings means, surprise, adversary or opposed, not devil. In spite of the current culture we live in, there is a difference between an opposing force and warfare. An adversarial force can simply be illustrated in the inability to bring two ends of a magnet together. So when the angel of Yahweh is sent as an adversary, here correctly translated from the Hebrew Satan, to oppose the prophet Balaam in Numbers 22:22, does that mean Yahweh takes on the persona of an evil Satan? According to 1 John 1:5, that is not possible. When the Hebrew word Satan appears artificially capitalized in Job 1:6, which changes an actionable verb into a noun, thus rendering it a persona, one has to ask, if light and darkness cannot abide in the same space at the same time, Then how did he, Satan, get there among those sons of light? We must remember there are no capitalizations used in the Hebrew language. Since Yeshua reinforces that heaven, the place where Yahweh's throne is located, is within or among the children of Yahweh, we must conclude that when the scripture says he came among the sons of Yahweh, if the force of opposition is against the words of Yahweh, then he must have arrived as a force within the assembly that accuses the brethren. Even then, we only find the Hebrew word Satan in the first two of Job's 42 chapters. It is important when reading these passages to keep in mind that the text of the original writings did not reach their final version until after the Babylonian exile. Before this exile, there is no evidence in Hebrew scriptures of Satan as an entity, only a force that opposes Yahweh. And even after the exile, Satan, portrayed as an entity, is still doubtful. Though the story of Job is very old, its final version is dated after the exile, after the Hebrews came into contact with the dualist Zoroastrian religion, with its God of good and its God of evil, prominently worshipped in Babylon at the time. The reason this transliterated Hebrew word Satan, that means adversary, has become associated with a persona called Satan is because this Hebrew word was translated using the Greek word diablos, which means devil, then assumed to characterize a persona. But the Hebrew word Satan is never found to be an entity. Here again, we find the theological influence of the translators overriding the original Hebrew perspective to support a replacement theology. In Hebrew, however, the word Satan is projected as an opposing force with all of the following meanings: divide, set at odds with, accuse, slander, reject, deceive, oppose, be adversarial. But not once is it distinguishable as a persona. The Hebrew word Satan exposes the principal strategy of evil, a force of determined opposition to the words of Yahweh, which at their core is found the thread of selflessness, looking upon the issues of the brethren as being more important than my own. And Yeshua exposed that evil proceeds out of the heart of man, not some mystical, ethereal persona that we can blame for all of our missteps. Yeshua's life is the testimony of the triumph of Yahweh's power through submission, the power of weakness made manifest through the choices involved in not seeking an individual's will. The force of evil is found in the self-determination of men, which is in opposition to selflessness. The force of evil is the attempt to manipulate control over circumstance by insisting on individual rights, to engage in activity that stands in opposition to the words of Yahweh, is to participate in the construct of the force of evil. Wherever opposition to Yahweh's purposes arises, there is always Satan. If Yahweh is the good, found in Exodus 20, then whatever force opposes that good is considered evil. This same view holds true for the serpent of Genesis 3, widely regarded in Christian theology to be an angel that had sinned called Satan, and having been thrown out of heaven for his sin, he came to earth and tempted Eve to sin. However, the Hebrew word Satan does not appear anywhere in the book of Genesis. In these passages, more than anywhere else in Scripture, we run the danger of eisegesis, reading into the text, rather than exegesis, reading out of the text, reading what the words actually say rather than projecting our own preconceived ideas onto the text and calling the process biblical interpretation. Metaphor, allegory, and symbolism are problematic when approaching Scripture. Words like do not lie, do not murder, or do not commit adultery are universally understood literally at their face value. So, since much of the words of Scripture are to be taken literally, and we're not given a codex anywhere spelling out what to follow, then which words are to be taken literally, and which words are to have symbolism, metaphor, or allegory applied to them, and who gets to decide which ones are which? The Torah does not speak in purely symbolic, abstract concepts. There is always a literal reality at the core of the subject, which is only then interpreted in a symbolic way to underscore and enhance the truth contained in that reality. The serpent, therefore, begs to be understood in this context as just that, a serpent. Not much information is given in Scripture about the serpent. But in Genesis 3:1, Scripture clearly states that the serpent was one of the most intelligent of all the animals that had been created. Another angelic being called Satan did not morph into or enter the serpent. That the serpent could communicate with Eve speaks more to the mystery surrounding the environment that existed between creation and the flood than anything else. The fact that the serpent was created like the other beasts of the field in Genesis 1:24 through 25 and was good also dispels any notion of the presence of an evil angelic being. That evil should even be associated with Satan at all is highly suspect. In the original writing, Satan was not considered to be an evil persona, but only became identified as such in the translated versions of the Messianic writings. Accordingly, Satan is an instrument used by Yahweh to accomplish specific purposes. There is much in the book of Job to support this view, with Satan appearing only in the first two chapters and then disappearing from the rest of the text of the book. Some believe the first two chapters were added much later, for in the last chapter we read, they showed him sympathy and comforted him for all of the evil that Yahweh had brought upon him. In Isaiah 45:7, Yahweh says, I form light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, Yahweh, do all of these things. The Hebrew word translated evil in both of these verses is ra, which primarily means calamity. Yahweh uses calamitous evil to incentivize men into seeking him. Sinful evil, which is standing in opposition to Yahweh's purposes found in his words, originates with man. Valentine's Jewish Encyclopedia confirms the idea that there is a radical difference between how Satan is conceived in the original writings and the conception portrayed in the Greek to Latin to English New Testament, and that this new role as an evil persona did not develop from the original role. There are no references to rebellious angels in any pre-Christian book. The figure of Satan in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament respectively emphasizes the difference in conception. There is no development, but a basic difference. It is only in Christian literature that the Persian idea of two opposing empires with Satan as God's enemy has persisted. With Job, Yahweh was endeavoring to refine a particular character of his spirit, that of pride. The Hebrew definition of purity is to be refined by fire. This Hebrew perspective of the purpose of evil will also be thoroughly discussed in a subsequent article of this series. Until then, see what it means to cultivate virtue. The irony of believing that Lucifer refers to Satan is that the same title, Morning Star, is used to refer to Yeshua in 2 Peter 1:19, where the text has exactly the same Greek term, Hosphoros. This is also the term used by Yeshua to describe himself in Revelation 22:16. When a similar thought expressed by Yeshua in Luke 10:18 seems to uphold the traditional viewpoint of Satan, it is forgotten that the Hebrew Yeshua only spoke what he had been taught of his Hebrew father. So, equipped with the understanding that Yeshua had no familiarity with a persona called Satan, and seeing evil as a force of opposition to Yahweh's words, when the entire passage of Luke 10 is compared alongside the primary Hebrew perspective given in the entire passage of Isaiah 14, there are striking similarities. When Isaiah 14:1-4 says that when Israel is restored, they will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon, then verse 12 can be seen as a part of this taunt song referring to the fall of authoritative forces opposing Yahweh through his family in this earthly realm. When compared alongside these verses, Luke 10:1-5 shows the exercise of the restored kingdom's authority over those forces opposing Yahweh and reinforces the power of that authority to the family of Yahweh. The lightning used by Yeshua in Luke 10:18, however, does not appear in the Hebrew of the Isaiah 14 passage, saying only that this bright star has fallen from heaven. This Greek word estrape, translated lightning in Luke 10:18, is actually derived from the root word aster, which means a star, also found in Mark 13:25, describing the same event. Remembering Yeshua's words of Mark 7:21-23, that evil proceeds out of the heart of men, then the heights this king of Isaiah 14 has ascended to is the elevation of the arrogance found in his own heart. The Hebrew word translated fallen in this passage is nafal, whose primary meaning is to lay prostrate, the same definition given to the Greek word pipto, translated fall, in Luke 10. This is a position of homage shown to a greater power. When the woes of Isaiah 14, 21 through 32 are proclaimed against those who have set themselves in opposition against Yahweh through the persecution of his family, Babylon being the foremost, along with Assyria and Philistia, can be seen from this Hebrew perspective comparatively alongside the woes of Luke 10, 13 through 15. Then we can see the Satan Yeshua is referring to in verse 18 as being the same taunt spoken of in Isaiah 14, 12 against forces of opposition ascending to heights of control and manipulation toward Yahweh's words, manifest in the pure hearts of his family, Israel. Yeshua was reaffirming the words he had been taught from his father, not injecting new doctrine. And he who overcomes and keeps my works until the end, to him I will give power over the nations, as I also have received from my Father, and I will give him the morning star. Revelation 2:25 through 29.